Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, this is Richard Herring. You're about to listen to my Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I hope you enjoy it. It is free. There are loads of ways that you can pay us back, either with money or just with goodwill. The most easy one is to go to gofasterstripe.com/RHLSTP5, where you can buy a series pass with the video and audio, or just an audio series pass, or an individual episode would just be a fantastic help for us. Or you can make a donation, either in return for a badge, one-off or monthly, which would be very helpful to us, or even just for nothing. If you don't want a badge, you can just give us whatever you can afford. It can be a pound, just a pound. I'm also on tour and going to be doing the Edinburgh Fringe, so you can come and see We're All Going to Die, if you're listening to this in the spring, or Lord of the Dance Settee is going to be my Edinburgh show in August and beyond. Go to richardherring.com to look into details of that. But let's get on with the show. You don't want to hear about all this. Give us some money. Just pay us a pound. It'll be lovely. We'll make more as it occurs to me. Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who knows when International Men's Day is. It's Richard Herring. It's November the 19th. Hello! Hello, welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, or as all the cool kids are calling it, Rahalastapas. Oh, yeah, a bit muted. Not good enough. So, not enough cool kids in tonight. We've got a fantastic show lined up for you. This will be going out sometime in April, I think, to begin with, and people will be listening for the rest of the human time. People could be listening to this in the year 2897, I'm guessing. But we recorded this the week of just after International Women's Day, which was I can't remember when it is. who cares? 8th of March, I think. And every day, I've get quite annoyed about this, as do many other people. Every time it's International Women's Day, men will go on Twitter and go, when is going to be International Men's Day? Or would that be sexist? So this year, I decided I would spend the whole day telling all the men who asked that day it was November the 19th, which took me quite a long time. I did it for about, I mean, over 14 hours worth of time. Andy McCaich, a long-time fan of this show, did storify the whole thing. I think there was about 700 tweets. I thought Twitter banned you if you did too many tweets. I thought they put you in Twitter jail. They didn't seem to want to do that. I was kind of hoping that would happen, to be honest, because it was going along. I had stuff to do. I was taking my wife out to dinner. But, you know, some things are more important than that on International Women's Day than your own wife. So it's November the 19th. But I think it's a very interesting thing, because it does sort of show the mentality of that kind of person is just knee-jerk, A, not to be delighted that there's just one day out of 365 days that we might celebrate women. That seems to me a nice thing to do. I'd like more days that we did that. But B, just to have the knee-jerk reaction. Yeah, why is it someone else's birthday? Why is it not my birthday? What pancake day? When will we have non-batter-based day? It's just like, and the fact that there is an International Men's Day. I mean, it's like a child, really, isn't it? It's going, you know, Mother's Day, when will it be Children's Day? Every day is Children's Day. Also, Children's Day, I believe, is the 1st of July. If any child asks you that, that's just off the top of my head. Forgive me if I've got that wrong. So let's have a quick look at some of the freaks in the audience. Just this is kind of fun. That man laughed nervously. He knew it was going to come straight to him. Generally the front row is becoming more attractive. I mean, you two have been here all the time. You're like the catalyst. You're the control that proved. So by which we can tell you're both quite nice looking for my fans. I have to say, especially you. So he hasn't got any hair, but you are quite nice looking. But you're quite new. What's your name, sir?
Steve.
That's good. Very bold. And what do you do for a living, Steve?
I'm a railway engineer.
You're a railway engineer. That is like every boy's dream. Are you really a railway engineer, or are you just saying I want to be a railway engineer when I grow up? And I'm just going to tell him what. So you drive railway engines. Oh, that's nice, good. he designs railways. That's useless. Who cares about that? We want a bloke just up the front. Your dad does that. Oh, that's how you got the job. That's how it works. It's full of nepotism, the railway. That is a very good job. See, it used to just be internet nerds. Now look at this bloke. He's out building. You don't ever build them, do you? Just you sit with a computer and go, put a bit of track here, then put a line across the track. That's how the track works. Two track, then put a lot of some sleepers. That's what they're called. You probably know that. Line. Then make it go there. Doesn't they just tell you where it has to go?
No.
No, you can just decide. It's going through your house. Bad luck, fuck off. Yeah, sorry, I should point that at you too. And are you his young lady?
Yeah.
Are you married or just courting? Yeah, don't want to marry a railway engineer, do you? Just that, you just have the fun of that. Does he, when you're in the bedroom, does he play videos of trains going into tunnels? In the other bed, that's in the other bedroom. What's your name?
Holly.
And what do you do for a living, Holly?
I'm a stockbroker.
You're a stockbroker? It's like proper people with proper jobs. I don't do many corporates. I did a corporate for some stockbrokers recently. Were you there?
No.
It was an award ceremony, so you can't be very good at your job. I thought stockbrokers were to blame for like all the economy going wrong, but it's not your fault, is it? Not really. It's the other ones. Well, it's because it's the more the banks than the stockbrokers, isn't it? It's just so boring. It is really, but see, it is boring. She's not offended. It is boring. Cool. Look, we've got someone coming on who's going to talk loads, actually, so I should probably shut up. Or maybe I should talk a lot now, so that we'll get to the rest of you in the second show. You're much worse than next week's audience. Slightly blown my mind. Our first guest here today is probably best known as being the host of Sitcom Showdown, the five-episode UK gold show. He was also in the film Wimbledon. As a lot, probably just his voice, I'm guessing, but I might be wrong. Will you please welcome Danny Baker, ladies and gentlemen? Hopefully. Danny Baker! Come on in, sit down, pull up a mic. Yeah, we're off.
Thank you very much.
Good.
Sitcom Showdown.
Yeah.
Hooray.
We'll just get it. I'm sure everyone wants to talk to you about Sitcom Showdown.
It's a weird thing, Richard. And thank you for having me here on International Women's Boxing Day. I've been doing this racket so long. I mean, longer than anyone, you know, with varying degrees of success, put it that way. Since 1979. And I genuinely cannot remember programs I made, series I made. Unfortunately, the public can. But when you mention that, I thought, oh yeah! What an outrage! What a stinker! But you know, that's it. I always say, if you look at Bing Crosby's CV, he makes a pretty bad film. That's one for the teenagers, Bing Crosby. If he makes some clinkers, then I'm and truly entitled to.
What was the premise? It was
it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Lousily executed. It was a good idea. It was here's why not anyone could care less, but this gives you the usual machinations of when you go into something, and I can probably talk up a storm, and I'm no good with the corporate side of things, quite famously. So I will stand and talk to you and a few executives at something, and I'll tell you what'll be a good show. I'm one of those.
Yeah.
And usually now, and I said you get. Because it was for a channel that just showed sitcoms. It was a UK comedy or whatever it was. And they said, we've got all these shows, but we don't want original content to do. I said, well, you've got these shows. Get in fanatics of them. So you have a load of people who love 40 Towers playing a load of people who love A&R Fotman. And you base it on whether they can do the next line. We come up the rounds pretty easily enough about the sitcoms and all that. And at the end of it, whoever wins it gets to show their sitcom afterwards. So it ends, and it says, well, today's winners were 40 Towers, so stand by. On the other side of these ads, it's going to be Gourmet Night. Shh. Well, not a bad idea.
Good idea.
Except when we came to film it, they said, we can't do that thing where you show them the thing afterwards. I said, but that's what you get. They said, can you come up with something else? And I swear it was on the day. So we got this stupid thing. I'm distancing myself now. Get away from me, Shafal. You'll drown us all. I come up with this stupid idea of the cushion of shame. It wasn't the worst program it's ever been on, but it was close. And we anyway, so that's how things like get away from you.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I usually have a few things going on at the time, but that was all right. It wasn't the worst thing I've ever done by some distance.
What do you think the worst thing you've ever
worst
done
thing,
is?
Worst thing I've ever done, and we'll take a vote on this towards the end of the show, I'm sure you all have your own opinions, is I did a thing called The Bottom Line. I became a consumer journalist. Again, it was a programme, it was ITV's answer to not That's Life even, but kind of Watchdog.
Right.
And for light relief, they said, you could do that. Me and Emma Freud and all of this, and it was 80s, and it was all, you know. But I, of course, sympathised with the perpetrators rather than the victims. I just did because my stuff wasn't like, you know, the life or death, but it'd be like this couple, you know, in Southport saying, we gave a man who said he was going to do our extension, he was going to make a gazebo on the back. We paid him £17,000 and we've not seen him again. So you go, you gave him 17 grand. Well, there you go. And apparently that wasn't the depth the show was looking for. And anyway, they try to.
But that is a great show. I mean, I think you should pitch that show.
A show
where you just go and go, what? You're an idiot.
I know.
Well, yeah.
But that's the duplicity sometimes in telly. They know people that are going, what? You just gave him 17,000. And these were, you know, they were saying, yeah, and we haven't seen him since. Well, I bet you ain't. Yeah, you know, on London Weekend once. Years ago, we used to do a show called the 6 o'clock show. I did it for 6.5 years. And upstairs used to be the serious end of, you know, we were the people who got the advertising, but it funded the more worthy shows, and telly loves worthy shows. As Stephen Colbert once said, the motto of all media is, if you're not scared, we're not doing our job. And that's how television runs to a large extent. And they went to buy a gun. And this never broke as a story. This is 30 years ago. And I remember them standing in the bar, and they said, "Boy," I said, "well, we've had a real problem here because we're showing how easy it is to buy a gun in London." Yeah. Well, you know, so we kind of set up this camera in a pub and went up to this guy and we said, can you get us a gun? He said, sure. And we said, how much? He said, 500. We gave him the 500. He went out of the pub. We haven't seen him. And so you go, well, yeah. No, it just shows, you know, out on the street it's tough. No, because you're a camera crew. I'll get you a gun. Here's 500. And of course, he's just gone to get us a gun. We're going to show how easy it is. He said he'll be back in 10 to 15 minutes. And we're going to show you how easy... He didn't come... Well, no, of course he didn't come back. But anyway, so yeah, the worst... I think the worst thing I've ever done was a thing called the bottom line for Thames.
Yeah.
But as I say, the competition is fierce.
But you have got it's such a broad career of so many different things.
It's a Swiss Army knife in the best way. It is a Swiss Army knife. And I mean, I was a... I didn't plan to do this, and it's an extraordinary, convoluted... Anyone who's... anyone who's read the book knows it was an extraordinary thing to do, to end up doing this. But because I was a writer, and then I got diverted away from doing it because... in the end, it becomes just a personality thing. And the horrible thing is, I really am like this. Everyone says, you know, they said to my wife sometimes, is he like that indoors? And she goes, yeah, he is. And so it just becomes, so you write, and then, you know, you're writing shows for other people, you're doing shows of varying quality yourself, and I can do stuff, but in any depth, I don't think so, but I'm certainly happy to be shallow. Genuinely, I just think it's quite hard sometimes to do the froth. And the radio stuff is incredibly upbeat.
Yeah.
It's extraordinarily upbeat, because the downbeat never interests me. No. So, yeah, I've been 35 years doing it, but does it amount to a hill of beans? I mean, who cares in the end? Nobody thinks about it that much. I'm under no illusions the audience want to think about anything I do afterwards. You know, I'm not Attenborough.
Well, but there's more to it. I mean, I think you put yourself down a bit. There's more to it than just...
No, I'm a good writer, and some things work. And I did Win, Lose or Draw, the old game show. That was fun.
It was
seven
great.
A day, if you don't mind. You just go off, change your shirt, come back on, and just do this.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's an extension of how I am, but... It sometimes fits and it sometimes doesn't. I mean, when I did the talk shows, that was never going to work. Ask yourself why. why they were paying me to listen, I have no idea. But they did. And it's not like, oh, I took the money. You know, I did a pretty good job. But I've never been a career television or media person, which is odd, given I've been doing it 35 years. But I think probably that is what leads to the unsinkability. You don't... put any store by it, and it also emboldens you when you want to tell them in forthright terms that you don't want to work for.
Yeah, well, what is very interesting about you is that you will say what you think and you will lose jobs, but you will bounce back.
I tend to think, but they're not, if it was just peak, you know, it'd be something. And most of the things, fortunately these days, they leave us alone.
Yeah.
They let us turn
they're
up.
They're scared, that's why.
Maybe we have to
let them go now, or start slagging us off.
Most of the people I've worked with, I've always worked with.
Yeah.
But the as we know, the management side of it, I don't get what they do.
No.
And I don't, God love them, but you know, the famous statistic, there's more meeting rooms at the BBC than there are studios and all of that.
Yeah.
And I knew that, well, the last time I did me nut and walked out, I knew the... I just knew it was another... They just wanted radio vanilla.
Yeah.
And to take a show like I was doing and say, oh, we're refreshing the schedules. What you're supposed to do is send a waspish email or write a piece in The Guardian. No, I won't milk it, but I'll walk straight up to you and I'll tell you what I think.
Yeah.
And the show before, they let me go on the air because they were all... they let us go on and do a show after that. I was saying, you and you, and they still let me walk in and do a programme.
Wow.
At the BBC, you know, instead of saying, well, we can't let him go on here, he's out of control, they let us go on and do it. But it's very cathartic, which is why I never feel the need afterwards to do it. And also, I just genuinely think that was wrong. Yes, it's personal, and a lot of people afterwards said, oh, but you know, people are getting laid off all the time, and Comet are just shut down. And of course, if Comet shuts down, you know, because I remember someone said that, oh, you know, who is he? 4,000 people just fine. Well, not fine that in that way, but the thing with Comet, that's a tragedy of a social scale. You fire 4,000 people, it's a tragedy. You fire one, it's personal. And I reserve the right to react personally, but they just ain't used to it in our game. They're just not.
It was an amazing day because it kind of, again, Twitter, I suppose, stoked it because you were doing your show and people were going, oh, listen to this show.
Oh, yeah, I hope it was a good show. It wasn't a particularly ill tempered show. It's quite funny, and I hope it realised some perspective on it. And it's also, it's just a tremendous amount of fun to do that. It just is. And we all want to do it. And when I don't do it all the time, but whenever I've done it, I've not regretted it for a second. All the time you're broadcasting, oh, this is good. This is good. This is what they want, as Chris Tarrant used to say. And I knew it was a Viking funeral, but I was damned if I was going to stay on for another 3 months to be refreshed out of the schedules.
No.
2 weeks before they're using me as a poster boy, not get rid of local radio. But it's because it is because it's just me and the audience. And there's no need for them to come up with, you know, ideas, you know, devil dogs in Hackney and things like that. That's their idea, the stupid double-decker bus going around asking about issues.
Yeah.
A one-on-one show where you turn up, do it and go home again doesn't give them a role. And that is the thing. That is the thing they could not bear, the idea that, well, why isn't this? I'll tell you the thing about, this is what, I remember now about 2 weeks before it, and some pipsqueak come in to see us, and they never before, they said, look, I'm one-on-one, but don't tell me how to do that, because it's, you know, it's, so in comes some kid, hi Danny, my name's Nick, okay, yeah, we haven't actually met, I've only been here a few weeks, I thought, yeah, you're trouble, you can tell it. And, anyway, I don't know if you know, but it's 50 years since the Beatles made Love Me Do. Yes, I know, it's been everywhere, yeah. Well, we're thinking of having a Beatles Day, right? Okay. So, you know, maybe you could ask on your show today, what's your favourite Beatles record? I said, what's your favourite Beatles record? So he said, yeah, you know, and people can ring in and say, you know, I don't know, She Loves You. And I said, how do you know about She Loves You? So he did, well, I said, no, mate, I'll come up with something, but probably not what's your favourite Beatles record, you know. That's all I do. I probably ask people, have you ever tripped up Ringo Starr? Because, and that's the rule, that is the rule, because what radio does, this generic thing, you know, it's your show. We want your views. We're here to represent you. Yeah, but you're getting paid. Do something. You know, it's our show. Well, what are you doing then? That abdication of responsibility I could never bear. You know, you're there, and every show you should be knocking yourself out and trying. Don't be generic. Be specific. Does your grandmother play the saxophone the other week? Now, how many people's mothers were in the Ivy Benson band? But you get, everyone thinks, well, up my own, but if one person's was and did, and she comes on the phone and plays, someone, no one to talk to, all by myself, no one to talk to, on the saxophone, that's radio. And you, that, and all the audience say, what? I have no idea what that was. We did one, what has it ever got stuck to your grandmother once? And, a lot of people said my grandfather, but it's just coming up with 9 stupid things, but in a management, they can't get there. Why aren't we talking about the issues of London? You know what? Because people in London ain't talking about the issues of London 9 times out of 10. And here's we don't actually like each other. People in Lewisham don't like people in Mile End. People in Mile End don't like people in Twickenham. Stop making that an amorphous mob that you can somehow corral into your vile pit of mediocrity. And so you just, anyway, there you go. But in management, that's not a popular opinion.
No.
So,
but it's interesting they don't leave, you know what you're doing, you've done this for a long time, and that they're coming in. The idea that anyone could come and suggest that.
Well, I don't think that
I've got an idea, and then it's,
what's your favourite Beatles record? And that to me, I mean, I just found that, what, Pep, and the station by and large is Pep, serves London as if it's, Truro, because it doesn't want to, it's just too vanilla, and the thing is, it's all poppy thing and all of that. Since then, it made me go back to work, and I've been forced back on the television, and nobody wanted that. So it serves them right. But it was a great, and I'll go back and do that show in a heartbeat. I used to love it.
Yeah.
Absolutely love it.
So let's talk about, just for people who don't know, let's just talk about how you started out, because you left school at 14, which is kind of a surprise, really, that anyone could leave school
at 14.
It was
the last time you could. It was the last time you could. In 1972, Easter 72, they changed it to 15 that summer.
Right.
Which I knew. And I had this idea that I didn't want to do any job where I had to show a certificate. Now, that's, you say that's it's swaggering, yes. It's also reckless. But I didn't do it like that. My friend worked in a record shop in the West End, and he was leaving. And he said, you should do it.
Right.
So I left. I was you know, always top of the class. I was bright as a button.
Yeah.
Well, that said, it was a school up the top of Deptford High Street, and I used to come first in year. And the fellow who used to come second in year is went on to be a roadie for Richie Blackmore's Rainbow. So the competition wasn't that stiff. But the teachers all said, oh, if you hang on, you know, you could. We always send two people on the NatWest course. You know, God love it. That's fine. That's all right. But it wasn't for me. You could have your own window in a year, I remember they said. And I went into a record shop, just led on to everything else. It's extraordinarily fortuitous. It just is.
Yeah.
It is. That's why when schools say sometimes, would you come back and talk to, I can't. I left at 14 to work in a record shop. I can't. There's nothing I can say to them.
Yeah.
Because it's different now, yes, but academia was never saying that. My son kind of was like ejecting university after 2 months because he said, I'm not going to stay there 3 years so they can tell me what I think about Jack Kerouac. Well done, son. Didn't work again for a year afterwards, but well done, son. And he, but I don't mind them grim old gestures, and I think, you know, people can be more resilient than that. But yeah, I did. I left school at 14.
Yeah, and you'd passed your 11 plus, and you
no, I didn't
refused,
do the I didn't do 11
you
re- plus.
Did you refused to, I didn't. I thought you'd refuse to
no.
go to grammar school.
No, I could. I'll come top in the primary school, rather
right.
I've junior mixed. And that entitled you to go to grammar school, but my mates was all going to West Greenwich.
Yeah.
And so I thought I'd go there, and John Lacey went, and he was lonely. John, we see John on the bus in his brown blazer, and but we were a good gang over there. And
yeah.
West Greenwich was a good school, pretty, you know, it was quite boisterous. And at 14, I thought that will do. But I've been selling stuff at Petticoat Lane and stuff for years. I've been going over there because my dad was a docker and used to get all sorts of stuff. And at 11 years old, I used to get two trains to Petticoat Lane and all the stall holders and knock out stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's terrible. I mean, I've got my own kids now. No, I'd rather have that because I say it's all different now. I'm not quite sure it is, but so leaving at 14 was just giving up the day job in some ways.
Yeah. And so this led on to working, being amongst punk rock at the beginning.
No, that
of punk
was
rock.
Again. That was, it's too unlikely. We're actually making the book into a BBC series at the moment.
Yeah.
And some of the things you do have to take pause because there's a wonderful saying that the difference between real life and fiction is that fiction has to make sense. And if you look at that, it doesn't. It's this, even reading it, people say, this is all a bit pat, isn't it? You finish in one job, you walk into someone who says, I do this, come and do that. And you finish that job and walk in, and it just has done that.
Yeah.
It just has done that. It's extraordinary. It really is the idea of even getting into telly because I was interviewed as a punk rocker, which I shouldn't have been because I wasn't really a punk rocker, although we were in punk rock, but only because I had a record that a mate of mine wanted who was very into punk rock, and I worked in a record shop. Dominoes,
yeah.
You know, real dominoes. And after a while, and I'm 60 in 18 months. I'm 60 years old in 18 months, and so you've got to, after a while, think, well, this is what you've done. This is not a game. This is what you've done. And I think over the last 10 years, you think, no, I can write a fairly, you know, present, but that's like being a Deutschmark after the First World War, who can't present. And I know how things work, but it is an extraordinary route. I'm sorry if it doesn't really answer any of the mysteries. Having never applied for a job in my life.
Yeah. But, you know, I think the force of your personality reason
Quentin
for this.
Crisp said a great thing once. Quentin Crisp was being interviewed by Mavis Nicholson. Now, there was an interrogator, my friend. And Mavis is showing the afternoon, you know, like an assassin, very quiet. And she just, and he was talking. And he, I love Quentin Crisp. And he was, and that's why I'm going to move to New York. Because, Mavis, do you mind if we stop now? I've just come to the end of my personality. That's what he said. Well, that's the kind of nerve I'd like to have. And she went, oh, okay, then thank you very much, Quentin. I've just come to the end of my personality. And if that happens, I'm done.
Yeah,
I'm done.
Imagine
you know?
If that was the end as well. They're just like, sorry, there's
we
nothing.
We don't have to finish this today.
Yeah, we do. But the thing I want to talk to you about then, that sort of slightly comes out of that, is that what I kind of, in the Desert Island Disc, you were talking to Kirsty about this, about the fact that you always just spend your money even if you don't really have any. You've never cared about money.
I've always been able to get hold of it. My dad was the same. My dad is the real hero of the book, not in a sentimental way, he just is. He's, you know, honestly.
Yeah.
If you want to see me shut up, you'd have a job now. He's been dead 4 years, but bring the old man in. It was an unsentimental, and I'd walk down the street even when I was doing lots of telly. Car routers would go, always be with me old man. My dad was he was a dock worker, but he was one of 14 kids, but he was an extraordinarily, he was a whirlwind, and he was explosive, that's the word.
Yeah.
I've never been physical. My old man used to, I mean, he said to me wonderfully once when I was, you've heard me say it before, when I was in one of the stinker reviews I got in one of the papers, and he sat in my house, and he had, whatever it was either Independent or Today or one of them, and he looked at it, he went, what are you going to do about that? I said, what? He went, this bloke's saying about you here. So I said, nothing, Dad. I said, you know, nothing. It's there it is, you know, that's what they do. You know the trouble with your game? I said, what? He said, there's not enough right-handers dished out. He's right. He's right. You try that in the dock, you'll end up in a fucking drink. And I said, all right. That story, again, in the book, my old man was fearless, you know, absolutely fearless in a terrific way. Everyone, he looked like a big fella, like Bernard Brezel, big fella. And he said, when we were in the Conran store, when I started earning a few quid, and he used to always run me anywhere, I'll come with you. And I'm in Conran, and my wife's got exquisite taste. And anyway, so we're walking around, and all I can hear in the distance as we're in there's my old man turning over price tags, mate. Anyway, so Dad, I said, Dad, why don't you go over to the pub? And I said, no, go on, I'll give you a hand out with the stuff. I said, you don't have to give people a hand out with the stuff. They'll, anyway, so we finished up, and I said, so this assistant had been following us around, nice chap, but a little fey, but Conran. Anything else? I said, no. I said, it's just the just that table and the chest of drawers and the cushions, thanks. He said, right. And as we, my old man said, I say, Chaz. He called everyone Chaz. I say, Chaz. He went, yes. He went, we don't want a receipt. So he went, I'm sorry, he went, we don't want a receipt. In my old man's terms, we'll meet you round the back, give you a score, we all win. So I said, Dad. So I said, he went, why? He said, we don't want a receipt. So the fella went, okay, I won't make you one. And he walked away, and my old man went, I don't know, why are you shopping these fucking places? I said, Dad, it's not a breaker's yard in Deptford. He's not looking for a drink. Everyone's looking for a drink. Don't you worry about that. And he may have been right. We was outside a car park once, Richard. A car park in Poland Street. It's only about 10 years ago. And it's because he took me out. So we're in a car park, and he's in the motor. And it's Saturday, so everyone's lining up waiting for spaces. Now, once you're in that queue, you can't get out of it. There's someone, but what are we going to do? Oh. Anyway, on this side, it's contractor only. So cars are going up this side and straight in. Now, I know that that's because they've got a contract. What's going on there? So I said, "What? That's contracts. Never in your life. What are we doing?" I say, Chaz. Bloke leant out of the booth. He went, can we get in the swim? I said, there is no swim. There's always a swim. Don't you worry about that. Anyway, I said, Dad, the fella don't know what you're talking about. Bloke gets out, starts walking down towards us. I say, can we have some of that? What's it going to cost us to do that? I don't know. So my old man gets a fiver. Right? We get in the swim, we go in. He could always attract what he always called approachable people. Everyone's approachable, don't you? Everyone's the best. Sorry, Richard, I do apologize. The best.
Please go ahead.
How about this?
I've had a tough week. I'm happy to sit back.
This is my old man. When I was doing the, you know, talk show over at the BBC, wearing corduroy jackets and roll necks. Harry Enfield was on. And my old man used to always, you know, he's proud of us. He'd come up and he'd always sit in the green room. He'd just sit there. Well, it's all free. So I'd say, yeah, lovely. So he'd sit there. And people like me, old man. And they'd talk to him. So Fred, you know, what do you think of Danny's career? So, well, you know. Anyway, so he's sitting there talking, but he's not paying any attention. So he's had a couple of brandies and he's talking to whoever's backstage. Anyway, so Harry's on there. And my question to Harry was, he was coming back with a new series. He's got new characters. Any new characters we've got to know? And Harry was just introducing a character that did very well for him. That fellow used to get very angry very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, Richard, it's all right you doing this show on the internet. But if you said to me, if this was a BBC One show, and you said, I'd say, oi, you know, Harry, no, that character, yeah. Remember him? So no one had seen that at the time, so he said, so he'd say. And Harry got carried away and knew the BBC couldn't use this, but because he said, I'd say, Baker, you might think yourself you've come away from the streets of Deptford and now you've got your talk show, but you're not Parkinson. And I, as far as I'm concerned, Baker, no. Now, my old man has heard the rise in the voice and turned around and looked at the telly. No, as far as I'm concerned, you're just a loudmouth cockney cunt, he said. My old man's gone. He's got out, this is absolutely true, he got out of his chair, walked to the stage door. Everyone's, Harry, thanks, that was all good, you know, great. The audience still applauding, and I'm going, my next guest tonight, Harry's come through the double doors. My old man grabbed hold of him, he threw him up against the wind. His mother could have been out there tonight. You dare talk to my boy like that? Harry's a, you know what Harry's like in real life. I said, I heard what you said to him. Oh, good. People are pulling me old man off of him afterwards. I've said, Dad. Because they turfed him out. They made him go and sit in reception. I don't care. I said, Dad, it's a character. It's a, that ain't a joke. We're calling you that. How's that a joke? He's right. So I said, how's that a joke? Anyway, every time I see Harry to this day, and he knows me old man's passed on, he goes, your dad's not with you, is he? Every single time. That was my old man. So it's very difficult to get lost in show business,
yeah.
When, you know, always at home, you, that's where you're from, that people will hold celebrities up against the water. Well, it was terrible, Danny. You're going to have to work with your dad. I said, you ever work with him? I've been trying since I was two. Anyway, so Richard, there you go.
So, yeah, but do you think, someone talked about this on Twitter, and I wanted to ask you about it anyway, but he was quite annoyed that you say, oh, I just spend my money and I don't care about insurance.
No, idea. I knock it all out always. Yeah.
But I quite like that. I think if... Oh, I mean, I'm not saying you're enormously wealthy in the way that, say, that stockbroker
is.
But, you know, if everyone... When the recession came, I just thought, if all the people who had lots of money went out and spent all their money, there wouldn't be a recession, would they? They went spend
it,
out
it's,
some
it's
of
an odd, and it, to dignify it, it's called a philosophy, and it's only possibly when you say it out loud, but everyone I know, up to a point, is incredibly generous. And it ain't a point of saying... I mean, like the other week, I went out with, you know, my old friends, and you can't say, I'll get the drinks or not, but I'd happily do that, and so would they.
Yeah.
And it's not about the big I am, it's just you... my dad really did put money under a carpet behind a wardrobe. He would pull the wardrobe back, and there would be the money. And I'm not naive about it, but I've earned some tremendous sums. And when you get paid, it doesn't occur to me... That, well, what I'll do with this is, I've never had a production company, I've never invested in anything, I knock it out. I take care of everyone around us, we go off on holidays, and we come back and we start again. He's always said to me old man, he said, you're like me, boy, you'll always be out of forage and get a few quid. And again, it's tremendously reckless, and it sounds very full of braggadocio, but I've always done it.
Yeah.
I've always sneaked off, and when I didn't have a tenner, I'd always, in the record shop, blimey, in a record shop, officially was earning £15.58 a week, but, you know... well, it was a little record shop in South Mountain Street, and that's Elton John used to work. It was tiny, and it was, at that time there were no mega stores, and you used to get imports, and a lot of people used to come in and spend a lot of money, and the till was in a little alcove. And there's a moment in in Alfie, in the film Alfie, where he says to Jane Asher, and about time you started playing the piano on that till. And she says, because she works in a cafe, she went, oh, I couldn't think do that, Alfie. They're like family to me. He says, that's all the more reason to do them. Blimey. That must be the only till in London that ain't bent. And let's dignify and call it survival. But then I used to earn fortunes, but I knocked it all out. I genuinely, Richard, I don't have any money in the bank at all.
No.
And I earn bundles. I earn bundles, and I knock it out.
But see, I admire it, because I also think, you know, A, why have loads of money sitting doing nothing? You know, why earn lots of money and then go to your grave leaving loads of money in a bank? Why do that? But also, just, you know, I think also it gives you impetus to carry on working.
It does. The idea that, I mean, you know, I'm doing three or four things now, but the idea, I don't have that fear gene.
Yeah.
And again, it all sounds very self-aggrandizing, but plainly I don't. I don't have an app. And my wife, everyone says, what's your wife like? She's worse than I am. Absolutely worse than I am. Stick it away with tax. I'd always done that. Well, I haven't always done that. I went skint in 1987. They literally knocked on the door to take away our stuff. And that's when I started doing the adverts, and I started doing everything. You know, yeah. I was on everything. Spitting Image had four dolls of me once. Sometimes it'd be a sketch with four of me in it, you know, me talking to me interviewing over there. That's perfectly legitimate. But like Gone with the Wind, I'm never going to be, you know, in this position again. They come round to take our stuff away.
Yeah.
But... you're supposed then to rethink life. Like when I was ill the other year, you're supposed to come out of that with some insight. And I lack that, which takes me back to that shallow thing. And it is shallow and it is reckless and it's not right. But it's just, it never had that. It's never frightened me at all. So I'll put the money away for tax and I'll think, what can we do with it? Let's all go away. I live in a great big house on Blackheath, the house that Daz built. We're a big, big family. My wife's one of 10. And it is, and I say it without a blush, people sometimes say.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The darling buds of Bermondsey, because I just like to be a good host. Yeah. I like people coming round. I like, and because I'm well aware of the absurdity of what's got us there.
Yeah.
But I'm under no illusions about, you know, it's not for everyone and it's not a philosophy and it's not flash, because everyone I know is pretty much like that. They really are. You look after everyone about you and you do it as if next week you might not be earning.
Yeah.
But they can't take that away from you. I'm never going to get to 84 and think, oh God, you know, I wish I hadn't gone to Hawaii for that month. And I had nothing. Again, that's in the book. Nothing. I flim flam because, oh, I can flim flam. A bank manager, I said, I'm going to Hawaii for a month. He said, Mr. Mackey, you're at the limit of your overdraft. I said, now look, I'm doing a. I had a vague hope of doing another. I'm doing this series, and I'm going to be earning so much money. I said, but all right, fine, we won't do that. And I'd give it all of that. And okay, and they underwrote this going off to Hawaii. The last photo in the book is me and Wendy in Hawaii, impossibly young, impossibly in love, and most impossibly of all, in Hawaii. But getting away with it is probably a bad life lesson, but that's the truth of it, yeah. But I don't have any money now. I really, really don't. I have nothing. I'm overdrawn at the moment.
Right.
I'll get a big old cheque at the end of the week for something or other. Knock that out. When? Come on, we're going to a comrade. See Chaz.
I think, anyway, I suppose, you know, if you've got an ordinary job and that you get a weekly wage, then that's,
oh God,
that's
no,
not going to work.
It, but is purely a consequence of this ludicrous harlequinade. Nothing I've done has any worth, but it has worth in terms of amusement and distraction and, you know, and varying degrees of quality, whether people like you or not. But I can't brood on that either. For BBC or everyone rings you up, I can do it. I'll deliver what they want. And I've written the series it's on at the moment, you know. Yeah. It's all right. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
But as a stepping stone to something, I have no ambitions. And I think that's important. I've never had any ambitions, either to be taken seriously or to be, for some chance of that, but or to build a career or to be respected. And you sometimes get patronised. You mentioned Desert Island Discs. And, and that was... we're not learning much about the real you, you know. I read your book and we come away thinking, who is this guy? And I said, Kirsty, is it Kurt? That's it. I know, but that is, I have no hidden depths at all. They really aren't. I've always had a rainbow around my shoulder, and it's annoying. The ebullience, I understand, is annoying sometimes, but anyone will tell you. I just, am like that. And it's only in recent years I've come to realise perhaps how extraordinary it is in both ways, good and bad. But I was the youngest of three kids. My sister and my brother were born in Deptford in a one-room thing. I wasn't, because my mum got pregnant with me again quite late on. The council said, well, you can't have all them kids in that flat. We're going to give you a new estate being built in Bermondsey. You've got a garden and an indoor bathroom. And they couldn't believe it. So I was born and couldn't help but feel partially responsible for all this. and all I knew was that, you know, it was great and the estate was great. And I just having the ump just never, to say that gene wasn't there.
Yeah.
It can be annoying. Yeah, people say, oh, God, you're relentlessly upbeat. You're Pollyanna. But I'm stuck with it. I'm fed up with people always using that whiff of the workhouse. Every book you read, you know, it was such a, really struggle to get where I am. I didn't. I haven't struggled at all. I know it's a rotten thing. I haven't. It's been an absolute breeze. Look at them hands. I come from a family of manual labourers. Look, never done a stroke. Never done a... So what entitles me, then, to be... have any kind of side in this? I mean, this is what we're doing now, and what a tremendous pleasure it is. This is it. This is what we do for a living.
Yeah,
I mean, because I was slightly ahead of it. I mean, I've been doing it longer than Stephen Fry or any of them, if I might put myself in that. I was doing it since 79.
Yeah.
And never wanted to do what I couldn't do what you do. I couldn't do stand-up. Actually, what I do, radio, I suppose, but that only came very late.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar. I think you probably could.
No, I can't do No, whatever it is I do, I'll do.
I think you know what you can do, and, you know, but I think it's... No, it is. It's very interesting. I wanted to... So even when you got ill, were you still... Did you still...
It didn't occur to me for a second I was going to die. That's all I'm going to say about it. It was 8 months of absolute... Just the worst, most disgusting. I had cancer of the head.
Cancer of the head.
You don't hear about it. I had it of the head. But to talk about it, and it's not... Again, people think, oh, you're burying that deep. I ain't. I it doesn't interest me. It's like anyone talking about their illness. I can just hear my wife saying, you're right, you're well now, don't milk it. That is exactly what Wendy would say. And so, yeah, it was disgusting, but what it was, I had cancer of the head, it was really horrible, duh. Well, yeah, but it didn't, it don't define us, and I've got nothing to pass on. I mean, to be fair, the geniuses who got me well, and they said, this is going to be the worst, other than bone marrow, this is the worst, but the prognosis is good, but, you know. Anyway, and when I come out of it, and they said, would you come back and talk to people who have just been diagnosed? I said, no, because all I can tell them is this is, no matter how bad you think it's going to be, it is going to be so much worse. One of the first things they do is dig a hole in here to put a tube in that all your food and morphine is going to go in. They get you. And I said, it's just... And I said, they don't want to hear that. Instead, they might see me and say, oh, look, he's all right, but... I would be, wouldn't I? You know, I said, they're going to think, well, and whatever it was, it was rotten. And I'll tell you how it come about. And here's something, this is totally blokish. I had a lump in my neck, that side, come up. And of course, didn't do nothing about it. And I was a much fatter fella than I am now then. I was big old Eddie Large. And I had this lump come up. But it didn't ever occur to me there was anything rotten. That'd be benign. That'd be nothing. Yeah. And so I put it off. Sure, when I went in there, it was nothing. It was a lump on the thyroid. And I told you, you're going to have to have it a little bit of surgery, take that away, but keep an eye on the other side. I said, how long? They said, you'll be off work for about 3 days. Oh, all right. Okay. All right. So I'm doing the radio every day at the time. So I took that away. And he said, but keep an eye on the other side because your thyroid's like a bow tie. And sometimes... We try it with a half, but it sometimes comes back on the other side, in which case you go on tablets. All right. 3 years later, I'll get this lump on the other side in exactly the same spot. Talk about a, you know, low blow. Thanks, what a trick. So, oh, look at that. When am I going to take 3 days off work? Oh, in the end, people kept saying, what's that sticking out your neck like a bleeding football, like an old boy's goiter? I said, oh, so back I went, and I said, it's come back, like you said. I said, on the other side. That doesn't look like your thyroid. I said, no, it is. Remember you said? You went, I know. Bang, bang, cut the test, cut the needles in. I went home about half hour later, the phone rung, and this girl who plainly was reading hello, she went, Miss Baker, that's his doctor, what's his secretary? Yeah. Could you come back? So I said, what now? She went, yes. Could you bring someone with you? Oh, we're not going to dinner, are we? And that yeah, you think, oh, yeah. Oh. But then you throw yourself into these geniuses at the National Health Service, which I did, and I said, I don't want any questions. I said, I've not got any questions at all. Everyone else is crying, because it's all, you know, for them, it's murder. I said, I've got no questions, because I'm not fighting this, you are. You know, I'm Normandy Beach, I'm Hastings. There's an army inside me, you're going to kick out like the, you know, D-Day. I'll lay back whatever you tell us to do, and I didn't ask a single question, but I had no... It was murder. I didn't think it'd be quite as rotten as it was, but at the end of it, I didn't think, you know, oh, well, I've come out of that a lot deeper. I, like Homer Simpson says, Marge, I didn't learn a damn thing. But yeah, it was 4 years ago now. Four years ago. They did say one of the things we might have to do if we have to, you'll lose your vocal cords.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't know how lucky you could have been, folks.
But it's, I mean, you know, out of all the things that it could, A, your vocal cords, B, your head, you know, which you use most of, you know,
well,
that is
a weird...
That's, I use my head the most, I think, out of everything.
Here's the thing, you don't look, forgive me if there's any other cancer survivors in the room. You don't, I mean, God, this is all natural. I didn't lose my hair because of chemotherapy. And all that stuff, you think, I used to think chemotherapy was a thing. It's as absolutely, it's like saying surgery. It's different for everyone. And they said, you won't lose your hair. I said, so one thing wouldn't have bothered me, you know. You might lose your life, but you're going your coffin with a full head of hair. But all the side effects and all the terrible things, yeah, it is rotten. But I genuinely think... I'm not very good at that. Writing the second volume of the book, I've got to put stuff like that in it. My brother died when he was 29. And I've got to address that, but I don't know how to. Again, not because... it's just not what I do. And also, it just seems like a drag to me. What do you think it's like? My brother died. My mum and dad went off the rails for a bit. I don't find that my forte. It's perfectly legitimate for other people to do it, but I have a great problem with it because I don't find it interesting. I don't find the downbeat interesting. I think my wife said a terrific thing at the airport last year. We were going to knock out another few quid. She said, she's very like me, Wen, and she going through all the books at the airport, and every book she picked up said, everything seemed great in Graham and Tracy's life, but behind the scenes, they hid a dark secret. Oh, I don't want to. Martin had everything in the world, love women, blah, 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 but the tragedy he came, oh, don't want it. And she just went, everyone had a dark secret, tragedy here, but it wasn't as simple. She went, you know what, Dan, if someone wrote a book, a lovely story about nice people, I'd buy it. And I thought, you know, and I just do believe that it's much easier, like the news takes over everything, it's much easier to be downbeat about things than actually to be on the upswing. If everyone was like, it'd drive us all potty. But fortunately, there's such a dearth of people who want to show the other side. I've got no other side. I genuinely have got no other side, as I keep saying. So thank God that there's not a rush of people saying, I don't mind appearing stupid. I'm not saying stupid in the sense of I don't think I am.
Yeah.
But there's a tremendous yearning. Michael McIntyre's chat show starts tonight. For people who want to show another side to themselves, I don't.
Yeah.
There is no other side, that's the truth.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, I mean, because I think, well, I suppose with comedians, a lot of comedians are worrying about how they're perceived. So, you know, some comedians would take a Daz advert and some comedians would say, oh, never, I would never do that. And, you know, so it just...
But I didn't
not...
think I had a persona or a reputation to lose. Awesome World. Orson Welles, the great Orson Welles, of course, who did so many adverts. And he said, people say, you know, he did Kodak cameras and wine, yeah. And until, you know, because he's trying to fund his films. I had no such, you know, it was for a good cause I was skin. But but I don't think of that as any better, worse than anything else you do. I don't want to remember anything. I don't think anyone certainly expects of anything like me. But Orson Welles said, for God's sake, even Lautrec painted posters. And I thought, oh, that's good. I'll have that. So for a while, when I used to get flack on the air, well, even Lautrec painted posters. What are you talking about? I don't know. But when Orson Welles says it, it justifies. I did the Mars bars in the same year.
Yeah.
I'd be the same. What was? Who am I? You know, it's not like I'm Steve Martin or something. It's not always doing. Look at my career curve. It's absolutely right. That's what you should have been doing, particularly as the VAT men wanted to take their furniture away, and they didn't.
Yeah.
But no, I don't.
I think it's sort of, I think it is interesting, and I think it is, you know, I think it's very interesting that this approach has led to this amazing, like, 30-year career, whatever this is, 35-year career, and that you're still working all the time, and it's, yeah, it's...
I know, but people don't, and why would they know? I mean, I write, you know, I write a load of things for other people, and I write lots of other things, and that drives women mad. You people don't know you wrote that. I said, it don't matter, does it? It's not your job. The whole point of a writer, I always think, is to be invisible. I don't think so. I think you should... I said, when? What's your favourite film? Gone with the Wind. Who wrote the screenplay? Exactly. You know, get out the road, do your job, and as I say, I remember there was a thing called Blood on the Carpet, one, John Humphreys. And they... They rang and said, "There's blood on the carpet here. We look at media and business issues, and look at the backstage infighting. We want to talk to you about on Radio One." Okay, you know, did 2 years at Radio One. Did, you know, it wasn't 2 years was fine. Then it went up the wall. And Radio One was, it seems odd that I'd ever been on Radio One, but did the same. I've only got one show in me, and I did it there. And okay, and I said, "But I can't do it." I said, "I don't really want to do this." I said, "I don't. It's not my sort of thing." They said, "You've got to love you a bit." Okay, they came back. Would you do it again? Then they said, "John will come to you. We'll bring a... You're in the West." Okay, I'm fine. At any rate, he sat down and started saying, "We've been speaking to people who Radio 1 about that period and the you took over from DLT. And you lost like 2-3 million. Yeah, I know. And anyways... And I didn't know that I was. He was looking at it as if it was tragic. I don't recall it like that at all. And I said, "John, I don't recognise this angst. I've not looked back for a second on that." I said, "I had a good time at Radio 1. There were pretty good shows. And there's reasons why it won't be." Same as Kirsty. When I broadcast, I wear various wigs on the radio. It cheers everyone up. Cheers everyone in the studio. There's no reason for it. And so I put these wigs on, and I've got this wonderful $1.99 bandana with integral hair. So you put that on, and you think, right, okay, then now we've got some fun. Right, so I've got a series of them. You just put them on, and people always come in and say, "Is this because of the cancer, you know?" And I said, "No." And if it was, I'd probably have a better prosthetic than a $1.99 wig I bought at a truck stop. But again, Kirsty, she was freaked out. "But why are you wearing..." It was all cut out of it. I said, "Because Kirsty, it's Desert Island Disc. It's not an affidavit. It's a radio show. You've chosen another song from your childhood." Because what I did was choose the first 8 songs I remembered.
Yeah.
Because I did for a while get into that thing. We've all thought about Desert Island Disc. And you can't help it. You get into that thing of saying, "Well, I think I'll play a bit of Mozart and then the Ramones." And then I'll just show... And then I thought, this is stupid. I'm just going to play the first 8 songs I remember, which I still like and must have informed everything else. So that was it.
Yeah.
"But is it a song your father particularly liked?" I said, no. "What are the reasons then you've delved into childhood?" I said, "Kirsty, if you like, I'll change them. We can change it. We're just fooling around in a radio studio. Look, I'm wearing a wig." As I say, I think, not particularly Kirsty's fault, I think sometimes in our game people like to give it a bit of gravitas because it validates what is basically a one-eyed, pin-headed industry.
Well, I think I really, really love the attitude you have towards it, and I think, you know, you're exactly right that a lot of both the management and the talent side of things is staffed by...
Oh, there's nuisances everywhere. It's not exclusively in the ballrooms. Not really, mainly, but it's not exclusively in the ballroom. No.
No.
By and large, there's not a lot of nuisances you meet, and you can always tell. But I don't think that's peculiar to this game. No. I'm sure everyone knows that there's the whole colour wheel of personality in any job you do.
Yeah.
There's a sense of entitlement about show business that makes people resent it more, show business. And I know. But I don't feel that people I've met in private, and I reserve, as everyone else does, reserve me, do me not like the people who cold call you. But for some reason you do it to an executive and that's a shock. There's proper ways of doing that. No, there ain't. I think he's an idiot. I just told him he's an idiot. Everyone in this office thinks you're an idiot. I remember I said to them, they were both like this before I went on the air. I said, "Do you know what? You do notice everyone calls you a weasel and everyone calls you a dim bulb. Up until that point, nobody had. Since I left, everyone does." Everyone I run it says, "I was with dim bulb the other day." And I said, "Dim bulb, weasel, yeah. I did something you only ever see about. The great thing was after it finished, which shows you the tremendous release, perhaps, for people. I came out there, it was like the end of Dead Poets Society. Everyone had come down from Radio Freedom, was all clapping in the corridors. Yeah. And I did something that was, you get rarely get a chance to do in real life. He started saying, Danny, we really should do this through your agent. I said, why? We're both standing here. I said, aren't you a shout? I said, I know what you're doing, you. He said, we're looking for a spot for you on the weekends. I said, you kiss that side. You kiss that side. And the art was, they said, I've never seen anyone do that in real life. It was a tremendous firework display, it must be said. I don't regret it for a second. My wife would French kiss him. Because since then, all of a sudden, as I say, people, well, you know, you've got to do this, you've got to do that.
But most people, I mean, most people are sucking, you know, suck up. They play
the
game,
but if you don't want to be defined by being a loose cannon, I'm not a shock jock.
No.
Anyone who is, the shows knows they're absolutely as light as a feather. They're silly. But more and more, there's no room for that. Everything has to be through meetings, do our agenda, and all this nonsense about this abdication of responsibility. I think people always want to see someone do something they couldn't. They don't resent people who do and say, well, I couldn't do that. You know, there was a tremendous thing Buster Keaton did. He did a voiceover, a talk at the NFT once over his films.
Right.
And he said the only duty of anyone who is asking the public to pay to see them is to do something that he said that perhaps they think, well, perhaps that's why he's doing that, because I wouldn't have thought of that. And he gave an example. I'm not for a second saying about Buster Keaton, but this is the crystallization of the thought. He showed a bit from Steamboat Bill Jr. when his house is in the way of a hurricane that's coming. So he jacks his house up onto the back of a flatback truck and drives it across town. So he's driving a house across town on a chain behind his house, and he's going fine, and he comes to the railway tracks, and as he's going over the railway tracks, of course the car stalls and the car's got over, but the house is now stuck on these railway tracks. So being Buster Keaton, he just looks at the audience and he looks around at the house and he gets out and he gets behind the house and starts pushing, because in the distance you can see a plume of smoke coming. And he looks out and the thing won't move, gets back in the car, looks at the camera. The plume of smoke's getting nearer and nearer and nearer. He gets out, he shoves again, gets back in the car, nothing. Now that you can see, it's a train, it's coming on. He jumps out, and in those days, of course, he did it. He puts his shoulder to the house and he goes, boom, and he pushes it off the track just as that train goes, comes through. And he turns to the camera and goes like this. And then from this side of the camera, another train goes, bang, and smashes the house up. And he said, that's all I wanted to do. Let the audience out, think me, and then double cross them. And isn't that beautiful? It is such a beautiful thing to think, well, Buster Keaton, that's why you're bleeding Buster Keaton.
Yeah.
Because other comedians would have just left the house on the track. No, go the extra bit, and that'll always, that is why people say, well, all right, you knock out a load of money, but perhaps that's what you do. I couldn't do that.
Yeah, no, that's true. And so,
You see, people see you work, and everyone has got mates who they think should be stand-ups, but it ain't quite as easy as that. There is a craft involved. It's not natural. It is neither natural to stand up there and do that and work at it and do what they do. And everyone at base knows that. But the resentment at the moment of anything that seems like peacockism or seems like entitlement, I'm better than you and all of that. Well, otherwise, you just, all you end up then is a soup.
Yeah.
You wouldn't say to someone who's come and put shelves up in my ass, can you do it? Well, I have a go. I'm just the same as you. Well, I'm not paying you to put my shelves up, mate. And anyone who buys a ticket should get the best possible show. And if they listen to a radio show, just try and keep things going.
So you are, in a way, you're saying, you know, this is all just froth and nonsense, but then you are saying it's more than that.
But that's not to denigrate froth and nonsense. Froth and nonsense, there's a place for it.
Yeah.
For God's sake, the king of froth and nonsense, P.G. Woodhouse, his whole books are about cow cream as it gets stolen, mistaken identity, but it's the idea that, as I say, we put so much store by heavy subjects, you know, that's why we've got so many fucking 24-hour rolling news channels, because that's easy. It is really is easy. It really is easy. Right, if you're just waking up, there's been a derailment, which is serious, of course, but the proportion, people don't want to be beat over the head. And sometimes that thing, when the terrible thing when that helicopter crashed in London, it was a shocking thing. But we can cut, you know, we can deal with it. Give us the facts. But they stayed there for 3 hours, even though it had been carted away. And they really seemed disappointed nobody was dead. They genuinely seemed like, well, Graham, any more news? No, at the moment, everyone's accounted for. Anyone with a square head jaw and read that crap? And, yeah. And I sometimes think, yeah, it's, of course it's important, but there are great news people and there are a tremendous amount of average news people. And they seem to carry every bit of weight and airtime that the rest of them do. And we're never going to roll that back. But the last thing you need is 24-hour news. You just don't need it. You don't need 24-hour anything. Telly used, the greatest thing that used to happen in telly was when BBC used to say, well, that's the last of the school's programmes this morning. The next programme is at 4 o'clock at Jack and Norrie. Until then, we're closing down. Because, i.e., we've got nothing worth broadcasting. Go off and do something else. And what we didn't realise what chutzpah that was. I used to come back from America and think, say to my mates, in America, I've got 200 channels on 24 hours a day. Well, careful what you wish for. Because now we know. And so it's just coming back to saying, the froth and nonsense in moderation and when you're in the mood for it is every bit as vital as state funerals. I'm doing what I can here with the imagery. I'm not Buster Keaton, all right?
I haven't asked you an emergency question. I'll ask you this. We'll get if you had to choose. I'm not going to ask one, but I am going to ask one. If you had to choose, Danny Baker, between having a tit that dispensed talcum powder and a finger that could travel... Don't wait till you've heard the choice.
I've already made up my mind. What's going to be better than the first one? Nothing.
And it is a finger that can travel through time, but just your finger can go through time.
I'll change my mind. I'll go for the finger that can travel through time.
I told you, yeah.
I can go with the finger that can travel through time.
What would you do with that finger?
We are about 300 yards from, if there was a time machine right there and you said you've got an hour anywhere in history,
yeah.
I would take it back to this very area, just this area, in 1972, because Newport Court just along there used to be all secondhand record shops.
Right.
And I genuinely look at old photos of this area and think, if I can crawl inside there, I still just live for buying old vinyl records,
yeah.
And that would be terrific. If I had a finger that could go through time... I'm so such
records.
A junkie. I could tell. I could run my finger. I would know, and I think I could do that and lift them out and bring them back through the portal. I could. Whereas the talcum powder thing is taken care of because, as we know, talcum powder is mined. It's mined like coal.
Right.
And you don't notice out in. I think the talcum powder mines are out in Romania way, and. You know, we're always used to that image of all the Welsh miners coming up covered in coal dust. The talcum powder, they come up smelling fabulous. That's really true. Talcum powder is actually mined. And I don't care how secure you are in your sexuality. You ship with a load of miners from Chile and all over the world. And so where do you work, mate? In Romania. Yeah, how much on a scene there? Actually buying talcum powder. What? It really is. Talcum is mined. Wow. And so I'm happy to, you know, let go of a piece of my chest for the good of the Romanian economy. But, yeah. But remember that talcum powder is mined.
That's very good. And
salt mines and all, but talcum powder mines.
All right, I'm going to ask it. Danny Baker. Just, why do I have to ruin it? I've had a nice time.
Yeah.
I've been treated as an equal, more or less, you know, silent partner. And I have to ruin it. Have you ever tried to suck your own cock?
I don't work blue. Never have done. Not because I don't enjoy it. I used to love. I mean, I think blue comics are absolutely hilarious. But then that gag's been Bill Hicks did it, and that's it. That is the one observation. The answer would be no.
Yeah.
And do you know genuinely what I'm thinking now? Oh, fuck it. I was in my. I mean, don't feel bad. Because I just said fuck it anyway, but swearing is another thing. I don't care. Our house used to be full of swearing, but I thought, oh, my girls will like this. This has gone all right. I say, oh, well, look at that thing we did the other night. I won't let them see this. Oh. I mean, my oldest daughter was 30. Don't get me wrong, but that's still like that. And no one wants to hear about their old man's self autofillating. Thank you very much. For autofillating is the phrase. But but that was my first thought. Yeah. Oh, we could go with
you
it.
Say I've ruined the whole.
Basically, that's it.
The whole night.
I've been 57. Years of Pollyanna. Suddenly you've turned me into Malcolm Muggeridge. Another one for the teenagers. I used to be able to do a great Melbourne Muggeridge, but there's no need for it anymore. I know. People don't know what you're doing. I've done that on the radio, but if four or five people go, dear God, Malcolm Muggeridge, James Mason, Robin Day, yes, sir, you were the back. An old orphanage for impressions that have got nowhere to go anymore. that's radio.
Oh dear. Well, we can't go on forever, and I won't ask you Josie's questions. That would be weird. Do you really have loads of laser discs still?
Oh, Baker's Folly.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I got in early on the Laserdisc. How do you know that's a great a great spot? I did, yeah, because you know it's another way of spending money. And there was a shop just over in St Martin's Lane used to sell them all. And for ages, I held on to that thing when DVDs came out. Now the quality is better. I tried, and they were great big machines, twice as big as this desk. And you put in a laser disc, and they were big LP size, literally 12-inch records. And they went in, and halfway through a film, it would cut out and go... and turn itself over in there. But the quality was better than video. I bought thousands of them. I used to go in, and what you got? Just load them up, I'll take them all. I've still got, like, Star Wars. I'll tell you the only laser disc I still got.
Yeah.
The only person I ever... went in front of, and I don't mean overawed particularly, but I thought it was David Bowie. So I used to write TFI Friday for 6.5 years, and David Bowie was on, and I'd never met Bowie, and like every, you know, all civilized people thought, blimey, it's Bowie. But he's little, he's quite slight, right. Isn't he? He came in, and he's sitting there during rehearsal, and I went over, and I said, Mr. Bowie, I stood outside Lewisham Odeon in 1973, round the back there, trying to force open the doors. And I thought, and he's got that look, David Bowie, which he's quite entitled to have, waiting for you to stop speaking. And I thought, I don't know where I'm going with it. Normally, I'm all right with it. I said, so, I'm by the way, I'm right, I'm sort of producer of the show, anything you need? He went, no, I don't need anything. And he carries on looking at you. And I went... And it, nothing. I thought, oh no. So I reached for this laser disc of The Man Who Fell to Earth. And he said, I said, no, I know you've asked, you don't want things signed, you don't know, it's just a thing, I've just stopped doing that. I said, well, would you do my laser disc? And he went, fucking hell, laser disc. I went, I know. He went, have you bought this particularly to be obtuse? And I said, and all of a sudden, me and David Bowie, I said, no, I've got thousands of them. And he went, that's what he did. There you go. And I took it away, he looked at it. You know, if my stature was small before that, he thought, you know, man, he literally saw his own outfit and went, fucking hell, a laser disc.
I bet you that's the only one in the world that's been signed by
Bowie. I think so, but it's signed by Bowie.
Might be the only one in the world.
It's signed by Bowie. I know I actually got the Beatles anthology, the TV series, the Beatles. I got that box set signed by McCartney. And he cried, I've never seen this. What is it? It's the future, Paul. It's called a 78 RPM. And he signed that. So I've still got some Laserdiscs because I was such a... I banged the drum so much for them. I've made them valuable.
What if the machine breaks down?
What machine? That got turfed out years ago. we're quite good at getting rid of things. Yeah, yeah. We had two Laserdisc players. And it's one of them things... Joe's got a DVD player. You don't have to turn it over. I said, but the quality's better. I didn't know what I was talking about. People used to say that about Betamax and VHS. What quality? Yeah. I'm sitting there with a jeweller's eyepiece. You know, oh, speaker there. Don't spoil the triangle. Ah, yes, this is it. Yeah, but the quality's all right, but it keeps cutting out halfway through, doesn't it? It doesn't cut out. It's turning itself over. I hung in there. Well done for the laser discs. I'm pretty reckless in buying technology, which I don't have a mobile, which is weird, but a laser disc. Yes.
No mobile. Yeah,
no mobile, but Laserdisc.
That's good. Well, unfortunately, I think we could talk to you for about...
God bless you. The audience have come to the end of their personalities.
They could do more. I haven't asked you... I'll do this and we'll finish on this, because this isn't a true story, but... There's a rumour that you were responsible for killing Bob Marley, but you had nothing to do with it.
Here's the thing.
I feel we've got another 15 minutes to go.
I know where that came from. Right. I know how it got around, and because I know exactly who to blame for that. me, and I had an accomplice, my big mouth. I was on the radio, and when I used to do 606, which is a... that was a, in the early we started 606. We never spoke to be called 606. Anyone who knows the football show, it by mistake got into the schedules. They were always meaning to come up with a name for that football phoning and all that. But so it, as it got closer to it, Radio Times said, "What's this show called?" And they forgot to send whatever title they'd. So Radio Times had just put 6 o'clock news 606.
Right,
football phoning. And if 606 took off like that, anyway, I was on there one night, and I like to make it peppy, and I would never really do it about football. I found it so because I found other people were doing football phoning. So let's talk about football supporting. Let's talk about what's the most extraordinary thing you've ever got into a ground. List of the most dangerous pitches in the world. What have you used for goalposts? Because football supporting and football are two different things. And somebody said something about the Whalers that night, whatever it was. And I. When I was at the New Musical Express, we used to play against the Whalers. Right. We used to play against... Also, there was a league, and we were the enemy, and all these bands. The Jam had a band, Madness had a band, right. And the Whalers were really good. When they came over previously, I really looked forward to playing them, but we never got to play them because they were too big in 78, when I was at the enemy. They were too big. But the older hacks, you say, "Oh, Bob, we always used to go to kick around there." So this fella's mentioned the Whalers. So I went, I played football against the Whalers. Hadn't, and he went, and I don't know why, but like in your game, a certain thing clicks over. You went, football. He died of a foot injury, and yeah. All this. I said, in fact, I said, I've never told anyone this because I thought this would be good radio. And I said, I tackled Bob Marley quite hard, and he went, Ross Clark. He looked at me, and his dad came up and said, there's a lot of shame. I said, because he was too quick for me. We were a good team, the enemy, but he was too quick. I said, about 5 years later, he gets gangrene infection in his toe, which turns cancerous and kills him. I think I might have killed Bob Marley. Now, for me, that's a roundy story. And he got, and for him, oh, no, I said, I don't think I'll do the rest of the show and make gags about it. Well, over in certain parts of southeast London, the Yardies didn't think that was very funny. Because it did, and I started getting a lot of mail saying, you know, you killed Bob and all this. And it took off. It became an internet meme. And even though I said the following week, I never played against Bob Marley. I said, you know, like, not because I was backing down. I thought it was a good story, but... The dags don't add up. I was at the enemy 78, 79. But that has stuck like glue.
Wow.
That you killed Bob Marley. I never met Bob Marley. No. And in fact, he didn't die because of a football injury in the toe. That's like, you know, Mama Cass's ham sandwich. It's not true.
Right.
But now, yes, there's still, and even though I said, I've tried to rectify it in the book, not through fear, but it just shows, you know,
yeah.
Even though, yeah, it'd be garrulous and do all that, and it's quite... As I saw it, quite a funny bit. I think I killed Bob Marley. I tackled him once. A lot of people now like to think, yeah, he'd still be with us. It won't be you clogger. You know, you weren't so fat, you'd have probably got the ball off him. There's no truth in it, but that's where it come from. I actually did say that. and that's where the confusion set in.
Well, it's great to have that cleared up. We're going to have to end it there. But yeah, ladies and gentlemen, massive round of applause and mates.
Thank you.
Danny Baker, let's
go. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Danny Baker. The music is by Pess. Thanks to Orange Mark and everyone at the British Comedy Guide, and Jason and everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre. Thanks to Chris Evans, not that one, although he's mates with Danny Baker, that one, isn't he? Or maybe not the one from the Avengers either. And everyone at Go Faster Stripe. Thank you to my producer, Ben Walker. This is a Go Faster Stripe Fuzz and Sky Potato production. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast. Do go to gofasterstripe.com and you can buy series passes for this and the other videoed series of... whatever this is. Oh, Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. You can also get a series pass to Meaning of Life, which is my 6-part show with stand-up and sketches all about the big questions in life. And if you want us to make more internet content, it would be fantastic if you went to gofasterstripe.com/RHMOL and made a one-off payment or even a monthly commitment. Maybe just £1 a month would be fantastic, and we will try and make shows like As It Occurs to Me, and if enough of you give us money, we'll make even more fantastic content. All of that money will go back into making other things for you to enjoy. So you can just sit there and enjoy this for nothing, or you can just give us a little bit of money. If you don't want to give us any money, or you can't afford to give us any money, please do just tell your friends about these podcasts. There's lots of it for free. We'll keep them free for those of you who are mean or poor. Hope you enjoyed it. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.